morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University and the studios of Audiovisual Services and the Learning Resources Center. In the 1960s, an era of intense political activism on college campuses, many student organizations emerged in response to the Vietnam War, other social issues including civil rights, the women's liberation movement, and the gay rights movement began to get some traction. And one of the organizations that emerged and had some considerable impact was called Students for a Democratic Society. The organization more or less disintegrated with the end of the 60s, but it has been revived in recent years with some of the same egalitarian goals and aspirations, but some important differences as well. And there are some students here on the campus of MTSU who are trying to organize SDS, the new version, into an official student organization, and a considerable amount of interest has been expressed. So here to talk with us about it today are Eric Fields, Jace Short, Ashley Renner, and Ariel Franklin, all students who are part and parcel of the new SDS on the campus of MTSU. Thanks for being with us, you guys.
Thanks for having us.
Eric, let me start with you because you were the first person involved in SDS who I got to know just quite by accident. We kind of met when Jim McCollum, the gentleman who was the focus of the McCollum versus Board of Education Church and State Supreme Court case, came to speak on this campus. How did you guys find out about the new SDS and generate interest in it?
Well, I was told about the new SDS by some people who wanted to start it here on campus, and Jace and Ashley were involved with that, so they may actually be better to answer this question.
Okay.
So actually,
Ashley?
How did we get involved in SDS?
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a lucky coincidence. We were researching student activism from the 1960s, and we were very much inspired by these movements and the tradition out of which they came. And in doing this research, we found out the new SDS was holding its first national convention. And we thought, you know, the principles that they stood for them are just as relevant today as they were then, if not more so. Mm-hmm. The need for social justice is still great. And so we got involved with the new SDS and started it up on this campus.
I remember my first semester in college, I took a history class, and it was the second half of American history, and we talked about SDS, and I remember being really interested in that then, about the Port Huron Statement and such. And of course, that was before the new SDS had been started, because that was 2005.
Let's back up for a slight history session with the Port Huron Statement, because Tom Hayden, who was one of the Chicago Seven, was the key figure in the Port Huron Statement, which is still taught about in political science courses today as a landmark in American politics. Tell us what it was all about. Jace, you want to take that?
If I could take that one, because I've done a lot of stuff on the Port Huron Statement. Tom Hayden actually wrote it, but it was actually modeled after the intellectual efforts of C. Wright Mills, sociologist, mm-hmm. at the time. The original SDS was heavily influenced by C. Wright Mills, and especially through Tom Hayden. And the Port Huron Statement was a basic statement of what SDS and the student movement was about in the early 60s. This is like, it was written in 1962, and it basically set a tone for student activism up until the escalation of the Vietnam War in 1965, when the movement really blew up. But at the time that the movement was still pretty small, Port Huron was very important, and it emphasized something that we keep with us today, participatory society. It's a very key kind of element to what we do in SDS, because we're not calling for representative democracy, but participatory democracy, one in which citizens directly participate in decision-making structures that affect their lives. Mm-hmm. So the Port Huron Statement is very, very important to us, and it's an important document in American history.
Ariel, when the original SDS focused a great deal, though not exclusively, on the Vietnam War, now our country's in the midst of another unpopular war. Is that something of an impetus, are you finding, for students to get involved in this organization? Is the war in Iraq?
Well, we had a rally, was it 2 weeks ago, and we generated, we got a lot of names put down on the listserv from people who were interested in involvement with the anti-war movement. I wouldn't say that's like our only selling point, but it is pretty high up there because it's an issue that we consistently work on and discuss pretty much every meeting and plan for events to counteract the war every meeting. So
campus activism is, it hasn't been totally dormant in the area between the old and new SDSs, but it has been much flatter than it was in between the two periods. What do you think has been responsible for the renaissance or the rebirth in interest in activism by young people in political issues?
It's complicated. There's probably a lot of causes. I mean, I think we can probably thank Bush for some of that. Some policies are pretty unpopular, and they're going to make people more angry than, say, maybe Clinton, even though he would do some things we would disagree with, too. So, and of course, the war, things like that. Hopefully, this movement will not fall apart when this war ends, because there are lots of problems with the world that are long-term. It's not just this war, and we take a broader view, so we focus on a lot of other issues as well. Mm-hmm. Anybody else have anything on why people are interested again?
Yeah, well, students have been, like, there's been a pretty steady bit of activism, you know, since, I mean, the 70s, right after the collapse of SDS and everything, you did see a very serious drop-off in student activism. In the 80s, there was the anti-nuclear movement, a variety of peace movements that were going on. But even during that 70s gap, that was the time of, like, women's liberation movement taking off. So there was student activism then, too. Mm-hmm. The 90s was the time when things kind of died off a little bit, but for the most part, there has been steady student activism, but the university has changed. The students in the 60s were trying to resist the transformation of their university into a business training apparatus. Mm-hmm. They wanted it to be the university, the liberal arts thing that they had before, which was conducive to political engagement and constructing citizens, not just workers. And they did not succeed in stopping that happening in the university. So the university is much less conducive to that kind of activism today than it was then.
Yeah. Which is kind of ironic because any university, not just this one, stated goals is to inspire and encourage critical thinking in the students. You can't inspire critical thinking without, you know, the people doing the critical thinking taking you seriously and criticizing when they feel criticism is needed and analyzing, whatever happens to be on their minds. The old SDS had officers, but it was also very decentralized. How do you all balance organization with, or centralization or decentralization with, you know, the need to stay egalitarian and make sure everybody has a voice?
People volunteer on a weekly basis for the next week's meeting. We have a facilitator who sort of like keeps things in line for the meeting, a timekeeper, a note taker, two childcare people, and a vibes watcher who makes sure that tension stays at a reasonable level. And we just, it's a voluntary, we try to make it so that everybody, people who don't do it very often get a chance to do it, and everybody is, there's no like prerequisites for being able to be an officer. Everybody can do it, and it works out pretty well.
So you rotate the roles. There's no one person who has this particular role all the time.
There are no permanent officers or positions of power or hierarchy.
Yeah, they're mostly service positions.
Mm-hmm. What sorts of activities would you all like to engage in and encourage in order to express your views?
Well, there's a long list. what sort of one thing I think that is important is trying to build popular education, as opposed to there is, you know, the university is a wonderful thing for education, but I think that education is something that has to be embodied in a more spontaneous kind of, you know, actions and participatory actions amongst people. And students are in a great, you know, environment for that, because we are already in an educational institution. And the kind of education I'm talking about is one in which the learners determine what they are learning, so mm-hmm. to speak, and it's cooperative and things like that. And there's a large number of issues we could cover with that.
Yeah.
But that model, I think, is very important.
Is it difficult for students to get their voices heard insofar as determining the curriculum, ideas for what they might be learning or what should be on a degree track, and or what sorts of topics should be brought up within a particular discipline in a particular class? Is it hard for a student to get any traction and taken seriously by faculty or administrators on that?
I think so. I think there's a long history within the university system of credentialism. Mm-hmm. Essentially, people with PhDs writing these papers that have little or no relationship to material reality. Mm-hmm. But the ideas like become popular and accepted within like the discursive terrain of certain academic genres. Mm-hmm. And thus it's like very difficult to make any changes from the bottom up, mm-hmm. which is where students would be participating. I think what we're looking for is a university setting in which the teachers would also be engaged in learning from the students. Mm-hmm.
Are there any models of grassroots activism that you all are studying that help you kind of figure out as a use as a guidepost to tell you how to go about it, or are you more or less learning as you go along?
It's a lot of both.
A little bit of both?
A lot of both.
We try and take ideas from different sources. We see things that we think are good ideas in terms of how to do things. We're like, hey, that's a good idea. And even if it's a group that we didn't necessarily agree with, you know, we get ideas from lots of different places, I think, and how we're doing things.
And then sometimes we just have to wing it.
Sometimes we just make stuff
up. Make it up as we go along.
Yeah, sometimes you come upon something that works when you do that, because you're being innovative. How big a part of what you all care about is environmentalism as an issue?
It's huge.
Yeah, it's an issue that we're concerned about.
We were actually going to have an environmentalist action, except on the KUC on April 1st, called Fossil Fools Day, but we were approved very late as a student organization, and by the time we went to go reserve space, all the space had been taken. Mm-hmm. So we weren't able to do something, but it's a very big thing, because I think especially for our generation, environmental issues are the ultimate determining factors, because global warming is something that you can only deny if you have very strong willpower and a willingness not to pay attention to what's going on in your immediate environment. So yeah, the environment is a very key issue, because we're the ones inheriting the world, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I think the environment ties in with the rest of what we do, actually, which is how most things work. We do totalist politics. We think the war is connected to poverty, and poverty is connected to racism. Mm-hmm. And certainly the environment is connected to this, because there are studies coming out on a regular basis showing that it's poor third world countries who are bearing the biggest brunt of the industrial countries polluting and causing a global warming. So it's not the people who are polluting that are getting hurt by this. The economic and social costs are coming on the poor people, basically. So this is connected to all kinds of other things, issues that we do, the environmental issues. So.
What about classism, which you just alluded to with a reference to poverty? Because the distance between the haves and the have-nots seems to have grown in this country exponentially over the last several years. And you all are going to be getting degrees and going out into the workforce, and you're going to have to deal with economic issues, both personal and national.
It's a huge issue. At SDS, actually, we have this thing, and in the nationally speaking, we have these caucuses, which are for marginalized perspectives within SDS, and one of the caucuses is a working class caucus. As an organization, we are really dedicated to economic equality, not just equality of opportunity, but you know, equality of substance between people, because we don't feel like individuals can participate on an equal basis in a political system unless they are they share fairly equal in what they have wealth-wise.
Most of the views being espoused are liberal, and as you guys know, because of talk radio and several other factors, the quote-unquote L word has gotten a dirty reputation. It's being used virtually as an invective in the past several years. Are we as a nation getting over that?
I'm not certain that we would characterize Students for a Democratic Society as a group committed to liberal values.
Okay,
I would say that we are committed to like more radical, deeper, fundamental changes. I mean, the reason like liberals have been criticized has historically been because they're treating the symptoms of problems. They're treating, you know, they're going out, they're recycling rather than talking about fundamental economic changes mm-hmm. that will be kinder to the environment. So, yeah, I think that the solutions we are looking for are slightly deeper than that, and we're moving in that direction.
You're tired of seeing people put a Band-Aid on a problem and saying that they've cured cancer.
Yeah, it's treating causes rather than the symptoms. Yeah.
I didn't know what she was saying. I thought it was interesting when you were saying that, because liberalism kind of sometimes uses a bad word among people in our group, is a certain idea of what liberalism is anyway, because mm-hmm. we would see ourselves as certainly not conservatives, but opposed to a certain idea of liberalism as opposed to conservatism too.
And beyond that, I think we're generally opposed to the traditional coordinates of American political discourse in general.
The tendency to label.
Right. Well, you have the conservative position and you have the liberal position. Mm-hmm. And every issue you have this kind of, you know, here it is. But I think that tends more to that tends to obscure what's really going on. And we're trying to realign the discourse in a different way.
How and why have the two major political parties in this country failed the American people? Well, where do you begin, I see, is the look on your face.
That's a broad question.
That's a long story, yes. Yeah.
They do not represent what the people want. Time and again, they will characterize themselves as, you know, ruling according to public opinion, but that's blatantly false, not just with the Bush administration, but with the Clinton administration, the first Bush administration, and on back. But basically, I would say that they are not, what they do is not in the interests of the vast majority of the American people, and they don't really listen to the vast majority of the American people. They run a public relations
campaign. And they don't have to, because of the system we have, is they're voted in every 4 years, and they can make these campaigns about simple incendiary issues like abortion, or are we gonna let gay people get married, things like this. And they can steer things away from more complicated economic issues that actually really affect people's lives and other issues as well. So when you're only voting every 4 years and you have to make one vote for every political issue, people are not going to have much of a voice.
Yeah. Is the time ripe for a third party that would really go somewhere, as opposed to the other attempts at third parties that have been made in the past throughout history?
I mean, there's a possibility that a third party could be preferable to the system that we have now, but I would argue that my concern would be that the history of American political parties, in recent history at least, has been one that is, in order to be elected, one has to fundraise, and in order to fundraise, one has to talk to special interest groups, and therefore one becomes very beholden to these interest groups to secure election and then re-election. So I think what we're talking about is, rather than a representative democracy in which a third party would play a role, a more participatory society where people would be directly engaged on a daily basis mm-hmm. in the decisions that affect their lives.
And there's a problem with parties themselves. Their structure is almost inevitably one that's not conducive for widespread democratic participation. Mm-hmm.
How does one motivate grassroots participatory democracy in people who might say to you, I'm working, my husband's working, we've got the kids, we've got, you know, they've got soccer, they've got music, they've got this, I'm active in my church, da-da-da-da-da, and they feel like Atlas holding up the world. And they just really don't, by the time the 5 o'clock news comes on, they're ready to say, oh, to hell with it, and click on America's Funniest Home Videos or whatever, you know, mind-numbing thing is happening on the tube. What do you say to those folks?
Well, I mean, I would say that's emblematic of our society is not structured for grassroots democracy, so we're struggling for that. But that's just true. Our society is not at all structured for that kind of participation. It's structured for us to be spectators. It's a spectator democracy, if you could call it a democracy. And it's designed such that, you know, we will work and work and we work more than anybody else in the industrialized world, and we get paid less and get fewer benefits. And it's sort of inevitable that after all that work that you will just kind of want to do something mind-numbing. So I don't know that we can convince a lot of individuals necessarily that, you know, they can do it in their current society. But we can convince them of the vision and help struggle for a society in which it would be possible.
Because it really is going to take more than just voting in local, state, and national elections. It's going to take something that involves more time, more participation, and more effort. Is it not, Ariel?
No, it is. I mean, I don't know. I think it's pretty clear to, at least to me, that voting in national and state elections doesn't really accomplish all of that much. And so I'm not really sure what I would say to those individuals who are, I don't know.
This is where, yeah, it's hard. That's kind of the question, is how do you get people, you know? And this is, we're not utopians or overly idealistic. We don't think that this change is going to happen tomorrow or the next day or, you know. Yeah. But yeah, that's kind of the question, is it is going to take more than just voting in elections. It's going to take a mass movement, really, to significantly change things. And how that gets motivated, that's a question to be answered. There are different things you could say about it. But
I think as we watch every day, there's five more countries having food riots. The economic crisis is really biting hard. More Americans are on food stamps now than ever. The United States is currently in the worst state when it comes to food for its own population than it's been since we started keeping statistics in 1960.
Yeah.
So as people are thrown off the out of their jobs and sort of that sort of thing, we're going to see more political activism. For one thing, people will just have time because they won't have jobs. But it's not just that. It's that political activism is something that comes out of necessity. It doesn't come out of just luxury. For students, they have this idea that it's just a luxury. But for me, it's not luxury at all. It's a necessity. I don't think I could psychologically make it through my life if I didn't fight for a better society, for a change.
Yeah.
And that's also, as many of the obstacles to the participation of the working class, especially working mothers, are structural, like the lack of childcare. We try to lay the groundwork that will facilitate their increased involvement by providing childcare at all of our meetings. And as far as I know, I think we're the only student group on campus that provides childcare.
The only student organization that
I believe so.
As we're sitting here taping, not as we are airing, not as you, the listeners, are hearing it, but as we're sitting here taping, it's the 40th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I've Been to the Mountaintop speech. It would be 40 years ago tomorrow as we tape that he was assassinated. Some people see the fact that an African-American and a woman have a viable chance to become president as a sign of progress. Where do you think that this country stands now with issues of race, gender, sexual orientation, and other situations where people in power view some of us as self and some of us as other?
SDS, as an organization, we try to steer away from electoral politics. But, I mean, as individuals, we obviously all have very in-depth views of things. So when we talk about this sort of thing, we are not speaking specifically for SDS,
okay,
I would
say. You're distinguishing between policy and individual opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Correct. Yeah.
Let's hear some individual opinions.
I'm kind of put off by this candidacy, especially in the Democratic Party. Early on, you had Edwards, who was the candidate advocating for the working class. He was tied to unions. You had, Barack Obama, who is a black candidate. You had Hillary Clinton, who was the female candidate. And I think this is problematic. I mean, as we struggle for real liberation for people of color and for women and for people who are socioeconomically disadvantaged, I think in lieu of that, what we're seeing is surface changes in terms of women being able to prove as they climb this ladder, this hierarchy, that they can be just as imperialistic as elite white men have been. And we see the same thing with Barack Obama, his talk about bombing Pakistan.
And in fact, they cannot succeed unless they adapt their style to fit into this hierarchical model.
Yes.
Because it's already been predetermined that you have to be more white-ish or more male-ish or whatever the requirement is.
Or adopt the politics
of those
people.
I mean, we see recently the thing with Obama's pastor, and that being a big controversy, and of course Obama trying to distance himself from that. I think I can speak for probably a lot of people in the group, but at least I can speak for me, say that, well, a lot of the things that his pastor said were correct. I mean, our society still is fundamentally racist. 9/11 was in part a response to incorrect Middle East policies in the part of the United States, and that's something that we need to realize, not distance ourselves from. Mm-hmm. So we see that Obama, he has an idealistic view of race, that we can just all get together and just we can talk about things, but we don't want to make any systemic important changes. But to answer your original question, I mean, I think it is a sign of some progress that we have a woman and a black man. Obviously, back when Martin Luther King was still alive, we could not have had a black president at all, even one who was representing the ideals of the power society like Obama is. So it's some progress. There's a lot of way to go on that, though. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Obama is necessarily going to take us there. So. Yeah.
Is it another distinction between the SDS of the 60s and the SDS of today that is probably important to bring out is that the old SDS engaged in some activities and tactics that you folks would not embrace. And you are totally nonviolent.
Well, to what specifically are you referring?
Well, the SDS, we got a reputation in the 60s for violence, yeah. Deserved or undeserved.
Yeah, I think that a lot of students for a long time suffered police brutality over and over and over again, and dirty tricks by their administration and things like that. And over time,
spied on by COINTELPRO and that kind of thing.
Exactly, and you know that's where it sort of escalated into that. And some students were pushed into very like kind of sort of violent radical positions because of that. But it was all in reaction to violence that was perpetrated against them.
Like the 68 Democratic Convention, right. where Richard Daley Bailey basically just let the police go hog wild. Right.
And we do civil disobedience stuff. I mean, our group hasn't participated in anything, but a lot of SDSs do civil disobedience things. They do sit-ins and, you know, chain themselves to different things that they need to chain themselves to, you know, that sort of thing. So, but yeah, we are a group based on diversity of tactics.
Does the new SDS embrace the kind of passive resistance that Gandhi and King espoused?
We are not. I don't think there are SDS members who are into principle nonviolence, mm-hmm. but as an organization, we aren't, because there's a whole thing that comes out of, you know, with Gandhi and King, it's kind of a whole metaphysical worldview that you hold, mm-hmm. about nonviolence. And individuals may hold that, but as an organization, we say diversity of tactics, okay. is our line.
You all, just to make to be clear, you all have received the official student organization status from the university yet or not?
We have. 3 weeks ago, I think.
2 weeks.
Up 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
The day before the Iraq War anniversary.
Oh, that's
it made it very difficult trying to
organize
throw together a protest.
But we did it.
But we did it. Made it on the front page of the DNA. So.
Did they accept the fact that you are non-hierarchical by comparison to other student organizations?
Understanding
not
that.
Really. We had to put a president down, didn't we?
Yes, we did. We have on paper, we have a president, a vice president, and a treasurer. But when it came to explaining the structure of our organization, we submitted the paperwork explaining our positions of service. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't understand that we didn't have a hierarchy, that one, they couldn't only speak to one person,
right.
that they might have to speak with a number of people and be prepared to field questions from a number of people.
Okay. If people want to learn more about Students for a Democratic Society here on campus, who do they contact and how do they contact you?
Well, we have a MySpace page. We have a Facebook group. We have a list server, and people can also become involved by getting in touch with us in person. We have meetings on the fourth floor of the library at 6 o'clock every Wednesday.
And there's no official membership. If you come to the meeting, you're a voting member. Anyone new should feel free to come. We would love to have them there.
Great.
They can come to myspace.com/mtsds.
Eric Fields, Jay Short, Ashley Renner, Ariel Franklin, thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at this same time next Sunday.